There are more wealthy people today than ever before in the history of the world. The risks they are exposed to through the assets they acquire and their unique lifestyles are significant. The bigger the asset, the bigger the potential loss. The bigger the potential loss, the more complicated the mechanisms for protecting those assets becomes. This show seeks to uncover the risks that successful people face so we can provide some guidance towards minimizing, mitigating, and transferring them. From coverage, contracts, and carriers, to client experience, technology, and claims. We will cover it all. Whether you're an agent looking to hone your skills or someone with significant wealth to protect, I hope this show becomes a valuable resource you can come to rely on to help you protect yourself, your family, and your clients. Welcome to the Private Client Risk and Resilience Podcast. My name is Kurt Turnison, and I am your host of this amazing show. In addition to this show, I am also a personal risk advisor at Erickson Insurance, and I'm the CEO of Risk Review, which is a software as a service platform that helps agents gather information from their clients and prospects in an efficient and modern way. So welcome to the show. Welcome back. For those of you who are new to the show, I'm really glad you're here. For those of you who have been listening to the previous podcast, thank you very much. I'm really excited that you're back again. And I'm looking forward to our conversation today. We're going to be talking to Mike Thayer, who I had the privilege of meeting at the recent Private Risk Management Association Summit in Chicago, which was about a month ago. Right, Mike?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, so we bumped into each other in the hallways. I was talking to OP Almaraz, who is a previous guest on the show, where we also were talking about wildfire. He runs Allied Defense, disaster defense company out there, which is cool. But we ended up just having a quick chat, and one thing led to another. I talked about the podcast, and Mike was saying that that sounds cool. And I said, "Would you like to be a guest?" And here we are. I'm really appreciative of your time, Mike, and obviously looking forward to hearing your expertise on this topic of wildfire, and looking forward to sharing that with the audience. So, officially, welcome to the show, and thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me so much. OP was generous enough to do the introduction. I was previously on his podcast, All Things Wildfire. I think that kind of kicked it off. And I think it's a great opportunity here that with the podcast that you have reaches, you know, a wide audience of risk advisors and insurance brokers, and hitting all the topics, right? All the risk and resilience, which is much needed in the high net worth space.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And there is there's so many things that we talk about as brokers and insurance companies and vendors in the space that it's just so important to just dive deep on some of these things. So I'm really grateful that we have this show and that we have the ability in today's world to disseminate this information in this fun way. Let's get started. And I think the first thing I wanted to do is just, you know, let people know who you are and what you do. And I know, you know, from our conversation that you are a certified wildfire mitigation specialist. And so I wanted to ask, you know, number one, what is that? And number two, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got where you are.
Okay. Well, I'll work a little bit backwards there. For the past 8 years, I was with the Wildfire Protection Unit of AIG Insurance. We had a mitigation program in place where we would go out and inspect homeowners' properties, but we could also respond during wildfire to prepare and protect those homes. I worked 8 years with a great team over there. Previous to my time at AIG, I worked in Colorado for Jefferson County Sheriff's Office on an emergency management team. We did wildfire mitigation and wildfire response, both within the state and outside of the state. So that's kind of my background in the fire history. So the Certified Wildfire Mitigation Specialist is a designation from the National Fire Protection Association. It's a first of its kind for wildfire professionals, similar to some of the designations you have in the insurance world. This is strictly for those in the mitigation space, planning, all those types of services for wildfire. It focuses on the wildland fire behavior, planning and preparedness, hazard mitigation, and public education.
Excellent. And is this a new designation? You said it was relatively new. What did this come out of?
So it started in 2017. There was a need for a certified program through NFPA to have that designation. Even though it came out in 2017, it really hadn't picked up any speed until recently, probably 2021, more and more people are getting the designation. The designation itself it's a little bit tough. There's a wide range of the topics that it covers. So somebody that may not be as may be really well versed in the hazard mitigation, but not so much the public education. And they want to hit all those points. So the study material is pretty wide ranging. So it's a little bit challenging, of course.
Well, that's important. I think anytime there's an educational program that they put together, you know, it's important that it is challenging, and it does bring to light a lot of these, a lot of the issues that you need to understand. I don't know, the Private Risk Management Association has a designation. There are several designations that have just come into the high net worth space, which I know brokers and agents all across the country have flocked to because of the importance of education. So we definitely understand that. Now, in our previous conversations, we've also talked about how you are actually, you have actually been to fires, and that you are a firefighter. And so this has been part of your job with the AIG Wildfire Protection Unit and beyond. And so can you tell us, because we have listeners from all over the country, can you tell us a little bit about what responding to a wildfire in California looks and feels and smells like?
Well, they all smell pretty much the same, depending on what region you're in, depending if it's forest or, brush that's burning. There's a lot of things to it. Things have evolved pretty rapidly in California. I started my firefighting career in Colorado. In California, there's a lot more resources available to fight these fires. And I know that the beginning of the program, it was very challenging to be accepted by the local fire agencies. They were a little bit leery of insurance companies coming in there and trying to protect homes. But as we worked side by side with some of these agencies and developed relationships, and as things escalated in California, as far as the number of fires, the size and spread, they were down on resources, and they counted us on us as a resource to come into the fire. And our main job was to prepare homes before the fire actually hit. That's how the program was developed, prepare and get out of the way of the fire. The reality is 2017, 2018, we're arriving at homes that there's already fire in the backyard, and, trying to manage that as well. So all our firefighters, they all had at least 4 years experience with other agencies, U.S. Forest Service, Cal Fire, those other entities. So you had to have the previous experience to even be hired by AIG for this team. So we were pretty well versed in wildfire arena. We would come in and prep the homes. And what I mean by prep is pulling combustibles away from home, patio cushions, dog beds, propane tanks, limit the exposure where embers could land and something ignite it and carry fire to the home. The majority of homes are lost from embers landing in a receptive fuel bed and igniting right on or next to the home. It's not a massive wall of flame that takes these homes down. It's mostly embers. So we were in there to kind of protect the homes. We could clear a pine needle or leaf debris out of the gutters. We had the ability to do that. Cut line around structures, put defensible space in there, even cut vegetation around. And then as a last line of defense, we had thermogel that we could spray on the structures. It's a good tool in our toolbox, but it's one that we try to limit the use. There's a short window of effectiveness, and then there's also the cleanup to consideration. So if a fire is not going to hit the house, it doesn't make any sense to gel it. It's a kind of a timely process, and we're trying to go from house to house to house. That's not something we want to be doing at every house when they don't need it. And in reality, if the homeowner has done everything before the fire, there's very low likelihood that we would have to gel in the first place. You know, those mitigation factors that we look for on inspections, you know, if those were taken care of, the prep time is a lot less for those homes. So that's kind of how we went in. Sometimes we get pulled into the fire to help out with the fire agencies if they're doing a firing operation off the road. If they're trying to put a backfire in front of the main fire, they would ask our engines to help them assist hold the road just because of limited resources. So there was all kinds of factors that would limit, you know, how many homes we see, the work we can do in a short amount of time before the fire arrives.
Excellent. And there's a couple really important things I heard there is, number one, it's not a wall of fire that takes these homes down. It's the embers. And it's the defensible space around the home that's super critical to protecting the homes. And it's the preparation ahead of time that's going to save the home. And so, the, you know, where we have this these buzzwords like predict and prevent, you know, yours is like prepare and prevent. You know, and I love that. And I think that that's really important to note. And when you're going, when you're out there in the trucks and you are facing down this wildfire, I mean, what is that like? You know, because these are sometimes fast moving, sometimes slow moving. And then sometimes it's just you're sitting there and watching the embers go over your head. You know, how can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's about safety first, right? We're not going to put ourselves in a bad spot. And fire agencies the same way. It's public safety first, firefighter safety second, and then protection of property third. That's the order. And that's how we would operate as well. We wouldn't necessarily put ourselves in a bad spot. We would make precautionary measures as we go in. We'd have people looking out for us. We worked with a liaison, which is basically what a task force leader in the fire agency world. So he was managing the engines. He was in communications with the Insta Command, and kind of looking out for our best interests in those fire areas. There was, you know, some situations where, you know, things changed rapidly, but we were always primarily in a safe spot to operate, to protect homes. And I think that's one of the misconceptions is, you know, there's always going to be a firefighter there to save your home. And the reality is, yes, we were able to make efforts to save homes and we did save homes. But there a lot of things have to line up. Timing, number one, and the luck to be in the right spot at the right time. That's why we always preach to the clients, you know, prepare your home the best can as if nobody's going to be there. Don't depend on us to be there. Don't depend on the fire agency to be there. There's just not enough trucks. And that was what we tried to impart on the inspection piece of it. You know, the more you can do before the fire has a better chance of surviving. But, you know, the media kind of picks up the firefighting. That's, you know, the real sexy part. You know, you're saving a home. It's wildfire. And it can happen and it's pretty exhilarating, but it's not the everyday. It's the prep before the fire hits.
Yeah. And the other thing that was really important you mentioned is it's you have a process. It's public safety first, firefighter safety second, and property safety third. And that, I mean, I think that says so much about just you have to prioritize, and public safety is number one. And you as a firefighter, you're putting yourself in harm's way potentially to protect the public first and then yourself and then the property. So there is very thoughtful planning that goes into all of these things as well. And, you know, talking about these wildfires, you know, we've definitely seen a lot of these events and heard of a lot of these events over the years, but we've also heard of the severity of them. And the severity has increased, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but can you talk about maybe what is causing the severity to increase with these wildfires?
Yeah, so it's a multiple factors. You know, climate for one part definitely has an effect on it. You know, extended drought, increased wind events. A lot of these large wildfires are wind driven. What we saw even in Lahaina in Colorado, the Marshall Fire, and a lot of the California ones, they're high wind events, which are different than normal wildfires. It's a lot harder to get out in front of and protect homes in those spaces. And then behind that, you have, like I mentioned before, the drought, extended drought, killing vegetation, and you have that buildup dead fuels. We go in these cycles of drought, and then we come out of drought, everything greens up, everybody thinks, oh, we're fine. Well, all that dead fuel is still below to live vegetation, and all it takes is ember getting into dead fuel, igniting that, and it could carry it into the live vegetation. So that the risk doesn't go away, even though we're in and out of drought. So that contributes as well. And then primarily, you know, over the past century, firefighting was the focus and not prevention. So we exclude wildfire for nearly 100 years based on thinking if we put every fire out, we're going to save homes. But the reality is, as we put all these fires out, the fuel's built up, the fuel's in the forest that saw frequent lightning fires that kind of cleared underbrush. Those were gone. So you had an increase of fuels in these forests. They're completely built up. It leads to the bug kill because they're weakened trees. So you see a lot of dead fuel in there, dead and down, trees dropping to the floor. If you have a fire in these areas, they're a much harder fight than a healthy forest that has spacing between the trees and very light fuel loading underneath the trees. So that definitely plays a factor too. 100 years of exclusion. And, you know, my worry kind of going forward, there's a lot of investments right now on the early detection and automatic suppression of fires, which is great. It's going to help save homes, but it's going to put us right back in the spot. And, you know, further down the road, you're basically kicking it down the road to the one fire that does escape. The chance for severity in those fires is going to be really extreme. And what we've learned in California, the majority of these fires, the top 10 fires in California, have all burned in fuels that are 35 years or older. So where in a lot of these risk models, the fire frequency is always seen as the bad guy. It's really the fire exclusion and the severity result of that burns homes. Most of these large fires, 35 plus years of fuel buildup. So, and some have no fire history going back into late 1800s. Those are the areas that are most vulnerable to these severe wildfires.
When you say exclusion, what do you mean?
So getting back to the fire suppression. So in the 1920s, the Forest Service, as a result of major losses, came up with a 10 a.m. policy. If they caught a fire that day, it had to be out by 10 a.m. the next day. And that kind of process didn't really change until the 1970s, where they said, oh, we probably need to reintroduce fire into the environment. And by that, I mean the prescribed fire to reduce the fuel. What they call good fire, beneficial fire that lightens the fuel load, so they're not severe fire when it does happen. Because all those years of suppression just led to more fuel buildup.
Thank you. Now, in the insurance industry right now, we know California is going through a tough time where there are carriers who have stopped writing new business. They have stopped writing any business. And rates are going up. Is there any perspective from you from the wildfire standpoint for, what's driving this with carriers? Is wildfire the cause of that? Is it part of the cause? How do you think insurance carriers should think about wildfire and how should they respond? How could they respond?
Yeah, it's interesting to see the response. And in California, it's a very tight spot for carriers, right? So on the one hand, for the longest time on the insurance commission side, they wouldn't let them raise any rates, or it was very difficult to raise rates. On the back end, because of all the losses we've had since 2017 and kind of moving on, that combining with the increase of reconstruction costs, the reinsurers are kind of backing off. They don't have the capacity or really the appetite to really support the carriers that are still in the state. So the carriers can't raise their rates to match what reinsurance is doing. It doesn't make it profitable for the insurance carrier to even stay in the state. So that's kind of leading to the exit strategy of all these carriers. And then the carriers that are staying, you see, strict requirements on what the homeowners have to do, specifically, in the 0 to 5 foot zone around the home, making sure there's no combustible vegetation, no combustible materials. It's something that has been known that saves homes, but now it's become used as kind of the hammer, right? If you don't comply with this, we're not going to write you. So there's the IBHS, California Wildfire Prepared Home Standard that came out, which is a great resource. So they've built this system, built on all their, studies, scientific studies, and what real world results, how that happens. You know, what they create in the lab is exactly what we see in the actual real world on wildfires. Bark mulch next to home, vegetation next to home, embers landing in those items, and carrying fire to the homes and burning them down. So they created the standard to follow. And I think the intent, was to have this in place for guidelines for carriers to kind of use and provide discounts with. My fear is that it's going to be somewhat weaponized, where you have to follow these strict standards, and a lot of them are tough depending on the homes. You have to follow these standards or you're going to be non-renewed. On the admitted side, I think that's going to be probably coming down the pipe. It's tough because I think carriers are looking to kind of walk their way away from California, but the reality is there's a lot of good money being left on the table. And more importantly, a lot of people being left without insurance. You know, there's areas that time and time again, they survive wildfires due to frequency, but they're the ones being excluded because it's considered a high hazard area. Well, if they have the mitigations in place, defensible space, home hardening, reality is they're going to survive the wildfires time after time, especially in an area that has lighter fuels. So this is the opposite side of a severe fire. The areas that see frequent fire in areas like Simi Valley, Agoura Hills, Calabasas, their fuel model, a lot of it's changed from brush. It's kind of what we call type conversion from brush to grass. In a grass fire, you have a very fast moving fire, which is scary on its own, but you don't have the extended duration of the fire. You don't have the ember production of the fire, and they're a lot more manageable. Flame lengths are lower. So in those type of areas, because of the frequency, those areas are deemed high risk. But in reality, they're not really going to see any severe losses. All those severe losses are in areas that burn less frequently. So in that respect, it makes it counterintuitive as a firefighter to see those policies being dropped and harder to get insurance.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, if an area of land has already seen a wildfire, it's less likely to burn again because the fuel's all gone. And yet those might be considered higher risks.
Yeah. I mean, to put it in context to compare it to other CAT, events. So if you have a town that has a fire and it has another fire within 5 years, that fire 5 years down the line is not going to be worse than the original fire. Let's say you have a city that has been impacted by a hurricane. Well, 5 years later, it gets hit by another hurricane. That area can actually be worse. That second event could be worse because of different events leading up to that. It goes to water temperature, wind speed, all that factors. But in wildfire, it's the fuel that drives that fire. And if there's less fuel, the fire won't be as severe.
Yeah. Oh, very, very interesting. And that, you mentioned the hammer. Some of this stuff, the mitigation, the new discounts may be weaponized and to be used by insurance companies as a reason to potentially non-renew an account, which is which is very interesting. And I have seen this with certain, with some clients that are dealing with this, and it is very difficult to go through that. Have you seen other situations where that is being done by carriers in the California market?
Not so much in requirements, but I see it more on the modeling side. So getting back to, you know, the frequency versus severity, the models themselves have been weaponized. You know, they look at saying, oh, you're in a high risk area. Nothing we can do about it, especially in areas that, you know, haven't seen a wildfire. There's been a lot of protections in California, the moratoriums, you know, because we've had so many wildfires. A lot of the areas were under moratoriums for 1 year, state mandated moratoriums. Well, once those expire, those places are getting non-renewed just because they fall in that high risk map. It'll be interesting to see as this comes down the line, because Cal Fire just released its updated fire hazard severity zone maps. This has been kind of a long time coming. It hasn't been updated since 2007. So a lot more homes, I mean, we're talking thousands of more homes are going to be considered in that vulnerable wild and urban interface zone. And that's where they're going to start seeing, you know, more issues with, you know, comply or be non-renewed, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, I guess as they broaden out those zones, yes, more homes are going to fall into that category and more homes are going to be at risk of being non-renewed because they're not in compliance now. So is the IBHS, is the state, are there any things that these organizations are doing to help prepare homeowners and clients in the state of California for those types of things? You know, the state's coming out with these new laws saying insurance companies have to offer discounts. But how is that being implemented? Are there any compliance type codes or new building codes or anything like that?
Right. So it's important to remember that those discounts that the state's starting to mandate is only for admitted business. Non-admitted does not have to file suit. And in California, it's very hard to find admitted solutions right now. And we heard at the summit, it's less likely the insurance carrier is going to be willing to do any kind of discounts just because the profit margin is so small because of reinsurance costs. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. I see the state is going to start to follow suit with what the IBHS standards are as far as that 0 to 5 foot zone, that non-combustible zone. They're looking at 2025 making that state code for new construction. And then in 2026, looking to have that as applied to existing homes. Now, we're talking thousands of homes, so I'm not sure how they're going to enforce that. They're also, I think, still discussing whether it's going to be completely non-combustible zone or some plants going to be allowed, but there's definitely going to be no bark mulch, no juniper, no Italian cypress, the highly flammable, you know, vegetation and ground covers that we see that cause losses. That's definitely going to be gone. But we're going to see that coming, you know, here shortly one way or another. And they admitted there's got to be a public education piece that's out there. I think that's something that's severely lacking right now, statewide. You know, the carriers will instruct it, but there's not a lot of education why, right? They just say, do it. And I think that's part that's lacking. IBHS has just revamped their website that does a really good job of focusing on the why. So it steps you through all the standards. And they have the videos backing up the why. They show the bark mulch burning. You know, they shoot the embers at these structures and show exactly why each of these recommendations is coming down the line. So I think that's a good resource that people could see. But it needs to be broadcast a lot bigger, right? You know, we have these state PSAs all the time for water restrictions and everything like that, but there's never anything on wildfire. And I think that needs to change.
Yep, I agree. Education is critical, and doing it on a wide scale is critical. So one thing I wanted to ask is about this non-combustible zone, because you know, I have several clients who have been insured with, and they've owned these homes for many years. And now all of a sudden the carrier is saying we need to have a non-combustible zone of 5 feet. Can you explain or walk us through how an existing property will go about making that 5 foot zone of non-combustible material? Because they might already have landscaping there. Is that just digging everything out and moving it and putting somewhere else? And what have you seen there?
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes that's the case. You know, it's the removable plants. If you have bark mulch, it's swapping that out for rock base. And you know, like we used to tell homeowners all the time, like, well, rock's really expensive. I'm like, well, yeah, but it's a one-time cost. How, you know, you replace your bark mulch every year. It blows away. It decomposes. Even if it changes color, they're not happy with the color. You know, so rock, yes, it's more expensive up front. But number one, it save your home, and it's a one-time cost. So that's something they have to look at. You know, for new construction, it's a lot easier. You know, it's about flipping the script about where your pathways and walkways, your how to interrupt the fire as it comes to your home. That's what they're looking at doing, and it's about reimagining that and working with these landscape architects. So that's another, you know, couple of missing pieces in the equation is getting these landscape architects, builders, developers on board with these standards. That's something the state's obviously going to have to do. But yeah, it's a pain point for sure. And you know, people are very attached to their vegetation. But there's, you know, it's something that's going to have to change. It's a total shift in behavior that we're going to have to see. And if you're doing it up front on the carrier side, that sets you up better down the line for the state side once it becomes regulated on the state side. So
it's a good point. It's much easier on the new construction. And, you know, when we talk about, when I talk to clients, when brokers talk to clients about their construction and renovation projects, this should absolutely be part of the conversation. It's, and clients do ask, what should I be thinking about from a risk management standpoint? Well, this is one of them. Especially if you're in a wildfire or a state that is conducive to wildfires. So I wanted to jump to a different topic real quick, not a different topic, but a question about the, and ask if you would tell us about the wildland urban interface and how does that play a role in this insurance question, in the insurance industry?
Right. So the wildland urban interface, there's a couple different definitions, but it's basically where the wildland vegetation or unmanaged vegetation intermixes with the built environment, any type of structures, whether it be homes or commercial. And as we know, our high net worth clients love to live in these areas because they're more rural. They have great views, hillsides. So there's a lot of expansion into this wildland urban interface. So it absolutely plays a fact because, you know, that's where the insurance companies are looking, though they're also the riskiest. And as they expand out there, I was looking at the other day, they said from 2007 to 2020, Arizona had a 122% increase of homes in the wildland urban interface. Colorado has 86, Texas had 82%. So it's not just California, right? It's, you know, California is starting to limit building in those areas, but other states, I mean, it's literally still the Wild West. They're expanding out there into these zones. And the scary part is outside of California and Utah, there's no wildfire building codes, no defensible space standards that are mandated by the state. They're called home rule states, and they let their local jurisdictions determine those type of building codes. So as we see this massive expansion in the wildland urban interface, they're not being built wildfire ready at all. And that's the really dangerous part, I think.
Yep. That's where the education comes into play with the landscape architects, right, the contractors, the builders, the designers, all these folks need to know about that. And it sounds like California, although that's the place that's having the most difficulty right now from an insurance standpoint, they are doing the best job with trying to mitigate damage from wildfire.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, typically, you know, in California, you do better percentage-wise on losses during a large wildfire event. California, maybe 10 to 25% loss within the fire perimeter. But you get outside California, you're looking at 50% loss ratio of homes inside that fire perimeter. So you can imagine an area like Breckenridge, Colorado, the foothills outside Scottsdale. What is 50% of the homes lost in a large wildfire, 100,000-acre wildfire, look like there? It would make the losses in California look pretty small compared to what's going to happen in those states.
Yeah, it's pretty scary to think about these things, but really important to be aware. And I thank you for bringing that awareness to us. I wanted to jump to back to something you said earlier about admitted markets. And because, you know, in the insurance business, we have the admitted markets and the non-admitted markets. And it seems like today, as a broker, working in California, like not working with clients in California, most of the business that I place there is in the non-admitted markets. What kind of impact is that going to have on us long term, on the California residents long term, high net worth clients long term?
Right. I just read a great article and we'll be able to share this too, that explains a little bit that goes into here. The non-admitted market, there's a pretty big thing that could come down the line, almost like a kind of a doomsday thinking of scenario. We haven't had an area that had a large loss for non-admitted homes. Non-admitted is not backed by the state, which works in both their favors. So they don't have, they could charge the rates they need. But if there is a bunch of large losses on the non-admitted space, they're not backed by the state. That carrier could actually be in deep trouble and not be able to pay out claims, being that's unregulated, not backed by the state. So if you have a large event where multiple, you know, we're talking hundreds of homes in a non-admitted space, which could happen as this shift happens, nobody knows what that looks like because it hasn't happened yet. But being in California since 2017, we've gotten pretty tired of the word unprecedented, right? It's never going to happen here. Well, we can't say that anymore because year after year, the unprecedented happens. So that's a little bit scary of a scenario. The next one down the line is the FAIR Plan scenario. So FAIR Plan is, you know, the resort, the insurance of last resort for the state. Again, it's not, you know, you pay a lot and you don't really get a lot in return. We're talking the maximum limits are $3 million. That doesn't really work for a high net, you know, person that has a $20 million home. Kind of the same scenario. You have a bunch of FAIR Plan homes and that these are backed by admitted carriers that pay into the pool. If you lose a lot of FAIR Plan homes within an area and the carriers don't have a plan to pay for that, you could see a lot of damage being done to those carriers and maybe some of them going under as well. So that's some, you know, scary scenarios that haven't happened before, but we've never been in this situation before.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly makes the, you know, the industry that you want to feel like it's solid underneath you, and you can totally lean on it and it's going to be there when you need it. It makes it feel a little flimsy, you know, with non-admitted carriers. And this is important too for brokers who are selling the non-admitted policies and clients who are buying those policies is to understand if there is a backstop to those companies, if they do go bankrupt, because if they go bankrupt, then you're on the hook for those claims. But some of the non-admitted companies may have a backstop that is not the state, but is some other financial resource that they have access to. So that's something to certainly think about. Did you have something else you wanted to say on that?
No. I mean, it's a great point. It's about doing the research and seeing what's available, because as I read that article, that was news to me as well. And it's something that nobody really thinks about too much. But yeah, it could happen. And then what does that do to the mortgage industry kind of going down the line when people can't get insurance and they're not being, and that's all, that could be a whole nother podcast. So I have some people like a point in the right direction for that scenario.
Great. Yeah. That would be very interesting as well. And so, one of the last questions I wanted to ask you, cause this has been phenomenal, like very interesting. I've learned a lot so far. Why is it, as we're talking about California and, you know, potential of non-renewals because people aren't complying or there's new requirements for defensible space for, we didn't mention ember resistant venting, but, you know, insurance companies will come out with these things that they ask clients to do to protect their homes. And if they don't, they will be non-renewed. But there's an education there too, because we're at the insurance companies are asking them to do that for a reason, to protect their home so that there isn't a large claim. And in today's market, we're trying to place insurance, more insurance, and allow customers to buy that. How do homeowners make their homes more attractive to insurance companies?
Right. It kind of gets back to what we talked about the firefighting agencies as they come into community. As they come into community, they're pretty restricted. They may have one engine for 10 homes. And as they go in there, they triage. They look at the home that has clearance around their driveway, that has defensible space, that has, you know, maybe that 0 to 5 foot zone, you know, cleared out, free of vegetation. Those are homes that are going to be able to make a stand and try to protect. On the flip side, it's the exact same things that carriers are looking for. So those home hardening initiatives, whether it be embers vent or at least 1/8 inch mesh vents to keep embers from getting in your attic and foundation vents. If you have trees near your property, looking at installing gutter guards to keep leaf debris out of your gutters, those type of items they look for. And then the 0 to 5 foot zone, which is the critical zone. I mean, it's basically where the battle is won and lost for a home. You know, having that free of vegetation, or at least the super flammable vegetation, no bark mulch, you know, those are the key items right at the home level. And then, you know, building out from there, having, you know, not a ton of vegetation around your home, whether it be planted or, you know, natural vegetation. You want to have it thinned out. You want to have spacing in between your trees. You want to have the trees limbed up to keep any service fire from getting in the crowns of the trees. So those are the things that, you know, number one, can save your home. But now that with, you know, the market being limited as what it is, you want to have your house, you know, ready to go, fire ready to even have a chance at getting insurance.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a broker, I definitely do. I want to help my clients do that. And now is the time to do it. You know, when you have insurance, when it's not a problem, if everything's going great, now's the time to look at it. Because you don't want to get caught off guard. And then all of a sudden you have to create a defensible space within 30 days and install ember resistant venting, which, as I know from OP, the time to order those and the time to have them delivered could be 8 weeks. It's doing these things proactively and when things are good. So, Mike, this conversation has been extremely illuminating and interesting somewhat like lighting, not to say this, but lighting a fire underneath us as brokers and agents and insurance companies to bring this education to our clients in the high net worth space to help avoid a disaster. And like you said, this is not just California. This is outside the state and potentially even worse outside the state because the codes are not in place, because the infrastructure is not in place, the resources are not in place. So, as we wrap up this conversation, I just wanted to ask, is there anything else that you think is really important for us to discuss here and to share with the private client risk and resilience audience?
Right. I think you just hit on it. You know, what we see going on in California, people absolutely need to be paying attention to in other states because regulation may be coming. But before that, it's going to be insurance carriers making those hard requirements, having those conversations for defensible space. I know outside of California, a lot of times when we talk to clients, it'd be the first time that people were even hearing about wildfire. They weren't hearing it from their local agency. So really having those conversations and starting to prepare those homes now, because that window is shortening. Number one, for possible wildfires coming down the line, we're seeing increased wildfires across the West, and not just the West. I mean, you look at the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, in Florida, you have issues, North Carolina. So all those areas that have any kind of, natural vegetation exposure, start talking to them about doing these mitigation actions. You don't want to be waiting till, like I said before, the hammer falls and you have to do it last second. And it can be hard. You have clients that are in Colorado that may be a New York-based underwriter, and they're New York people. They don't know about wildfire. So it's about educating them, especially as a secondary home. Those homes are extremely vulnerable because they're not being seen on a regular basis. They may not be upkept all the time. They're only visited in the winter. And then when they're being inspected, a lot of time, maybe there's nobody there to convey the risk. So be there for an inspection, walk them through the process and what they need to do for those large properties. Because those ones in Colorado and those ski areas, are extremely vulnerable.
Exceptional point. As high net worth brokers, our clients bring us to all areas of the country and outside of the country. And we are not local to every one of them. And nor can we visit everyone, even though I would love to visit every one of their homes.
Right.
We can't, and we don't, and I don't. But super important to have that local knowledge and to be able to share that with clients so that they can make the necessary actions. And you say, wildfires outside of California, and you talk about on the East Coast. We had a wildfire in Connecticut. And I heard the news, and it was in my town, and I was like, "What? We have a wildfire in my town?" They can happen anywhere, and certainly something to be aware of. So this has been excellent, Mike. One thing I wanted to ask you is, if people have a question for you, they would like to get in touch with you. What is the best way for them to do that?
Probably currently, right now, LinkedIn. And if you can make the contact available on the website, that'll probably be the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Absolutely. No, thank you very much. So thanks again for this conversation. I learned a ton, and I hope our audience did too. And thank you to the audience for tuning in for this amazing conversation. Mike, this was great. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Yep. Well, I look forward to chatting with you again, hopefully soon. And to everybody who's listening, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I know that's coming up in a few days. And if you're listening to this as well, and you're headed to you're going to be attending the Private Risk Management Association New York Metro Chapter event that I am a part of, I look forward to seeing you there. So thanks again, Mike, and thank you to the audience. You have a wonderful day, everyone.